Case this morning is In Re Marriage of Remick.
Thank you, Your Honors. May I have 3 minutes for rebuttal, please?
You may.
Good morning, and may I please the court. My name's Dennis McLaughlin. Seated at council table is Robert Cadronell. We're the attorneys representing the former wife, Tammy Remick, in this appeal. We ask this court to reverse and remand the findings of fact and conclusions of law and decree of dissolution as it relates to the maintenance and child support provisions. Remand the child support order, reverse and remand and vacate the order clarifying the decree in child support that was entered in November of 2011. Vacate the $500.
That was why.
Yeah, sure. First of all, let's talk about the maintenance provision. The maintenance provision in the decree of dissolution was considered to be not, was ordered by the judge after a bench trial to be non-modifiable.
Where did that idea originate? Did a party first suggest it be non-modifiable, or did the judge?
It wasn't in the oral ruling.
That doesn't answer my question. Was it first in the pleadings your client proposed as findings and a decree, or was it somewhere else? And where did it come from? Because it wasn't in the oral ruling of the judge.
Right. Yes. When we submitted final orders, we said there was a provision in there that said that it was non-modifiable. It was
so your client first suggested it to the court before the court adopted.
Right. And then there was a response, and then in the reply, we pointed out that, wait a second, that is error. Wherever it came from, whether you sign ours or whether you sign theirs, it doesn't matter. That provision has to be stricken because it's error. So the error was pointed out specifically in the reply that was filed and citing the case of Short. So the court was fully aware that there was an objection made, no matter whose documents the court signed.
This is just a Scrivener's error, or was your client seeking to gain some leverage with the judge by suggesting that the maintenance be non-modifiable?
The Scrivener's error. It was a carryover from a prior agreed-upon decree.
So someone just cut and pasted too much.
Yeah, paste the improper provision. Exactly. And that someone would have to be me because no matter who prepared it, it's my responsibility. Okay. But, and then when we realized that the documents had that before they were signed, we said, no, you can't do this. And the judge ignored it and signed the document containing that provision. And therefore, that's error. And we're asking that you reverse and remand the maintenance provision. The second, as it relates to child support, this is a little bit more confusing because there's a difference between what is child support and what is undifferentiated.
If you could explain what economic difference would result if your position is adopted and we send this back to trial court. Will your client really get any more child support?
Well,
You're suggesting that certain categories of income weren't properly included in the worksheets, but were above the table amounts, so the court's going to have a different way of arriving at the amount.
Yeah, she would get more child support because of the fact that the percentages would be different. If you included the CBI income, which is one of the largest components of Mr. Remick's salary, in there, it wouldn't be a 50-50 split of the basic calculation for both parents based off their net operating incomes. It would be a disproportionate split, and then Mr. Remick would have to pay a larger portion of the raw amount. Okay, because you have an amount that's split between the two parents, and he gets a larger proportion. And the CBI income was one of his biggest components of his salary. Of his overall compensation package. There's also the ESPP program, which was a contract-related benefit that wasn't included, and there were also stock awards that were not included, all three of which needed to be included that would have upped his percentage. So, yes, there would be a difference. Not only would there be a difference in the actual transfer payment under the child support, but when you included those amounts in there, then you would be also...
For the extraordinary expenses.
Exactly, which are required to be done. So, yes, there is a financial difference on that. The next would be there is a provision in there...
And what's your understanding of why the court didn't include that?
I don't know.
So you did argue it and draw it to the court's attention?
Oh, yeah, we drew it. And again, in our reply to the response alternative set of final documents, we cited it. We showed the pay stub. We said that look how much the CBI is. And basically, Judge Hillier just said, well, I'm doing it this way. And it was hard to tell because...
What evidence was presented during the course of the trial as to whether this was recurring or non-recurring?
Well, Mr. Remick testified that it was recurring for at least the past 2 years, both in the year 2010, where we had
Did he testify about whether he anticipated it would continue in the future or whether he had received it beyond 2 years back in time?
The testimony, the best that I can recall from the record in reviewing it, was we had a pay stub that showed it in 2010. Yeah, we showed it in 2009.
Says, I want to know what evidence was either that he was likely to get this again the next year or that he'd gotten it more than 2 years ago. We know that he got it during those 2 years from the documentary evidence.
Well, the testimony was it was a discretionary bonus with Microsoft, and... That's what we understood. There was nothing that it was like. There was
testimony that they had announced they weren't going to exercise their discretion next year.
No. And the respondent's response brief doesn't show that either. And the other thing that I'd like to touch on briefly is the difference between, because this is one of the essential differences, is the difference between undifferentiated family support and child support. While it was a thought that if you put half the gross income to Ms. Remick, that might be better for them for tax purposes, and then she'd pay tax on the whole amount if she got half of the gross income, the trial court said half of the net income, and then the respondent's counsel suggested that that be called child support so that it be not taxable to the client, but then use the term undifferentiated family support and child support. Ultimately, it was undifferentiated family support, which is totally taxable to Ms. Remick. Thank you.
May it please the court, Valerie Villison for the respondent, Enoch Remick. We're asking the court to affirm the trial court's orders. The errors that the wife alleges regarding child support and maintenance were either invited based on a narrow interpretation of the orders or could have been resolved without the need of an appeal, or ultimately harmless. First, with regards to the maintenance provision that was first discussed, Your Honor, you're correct that this actually started with the wife. The wife proposed in her final orders that maintenance be non-modifiable, and that's at CP 485. The husband agreed in his own proposed final order, said, fine, that's what you want, I agree. On reply, counsel says that they pointed out this error, but if you look at CP 208, where they supposedly, you know, brought out this error in a single-spaced eight-page table, all it says is, citing Short, it should be, it can only be non-modifiable if it was based on agreement, not ordered by the trial court. But
wasn't that enough?
They didn't say it was a Scrivener's error. There was nothing saying, oh, yes, you're right, that was a mistake in our first paperwork. All the trial court saw was it had to be based on agreement and that both parties had proposed it. So that was sufficient. That's the substantial evidence to support that non-modifiable provision could have been included. Nobody moved for reconsideration. They could have brought it to his attention if, in fact, that was a Scrivener's error, but that was not pointed out in their paperwork.
So the Scrivener's error claim is first made on appeal?
Correct. With regards to the income, counsel's incorrect. The transfer payment would remain exactly the same, regardless of what income is included. The trial court awarded $2,000 a month in child support, which was above any amount of child support that the wife would have gotten based on the incomes they're proposing. For example, if you look at CP5...
What methodology did the trial court use to decide that that was the right number?
I believe, actually, in their oral ruling, I don't have the site. Trial court essentially said that this was the amount of child support that he thought was right for these children.
I mean, did he say this is all you need to maintain this household, there's no need for more support, or did he have some mathematical formula plugged in that produced the number 2,000?
There was no mathematical formula. What the trial court was stating that it was exercising its discretion. It recognized whether you include the CBI income or if you don't. These were parties that had income that went above the standard calculation, and said, because of that, I'm exercising my discretion, and I'm awarding it above that. And that's true, because if you look at their own proposed final orders, CP 500, they included income that they thought the husband should have had, the trial court should have included, and their transfer payment was still $1,675, which was less than
the allocation of extraordinary expenses.
It did change the allocation of extraordinary expenses, but again, this is where the trial court was exercising its discretion.
Does the trial court have discretion with regard to the application of percentages of income to extraordinary expenses?
It does if it's already exercised its discretion by deviating to a different amount other than the transfer payment, and that's marriage of Casey.
Okay, but this isn't a deviation, is it, when it's above the standard calculation?
No, but the trial court also found that there was a deviation that was warranted for tax purposes. There was a finding for a deviation. But that is correct. When you're above $12,000, I don't believe it's considered a quote-unquote deviation. Also, with regards to the undifferentiated support that counsel is talking about, this argument still doesn't really make much sense to me. They're using this terminology and saying, well, boom, she's going to get dinged with taxes. But it's clear from the trial court's order, and the husband doesn't disagree, that amount of child support, I mean, $6,000 for the first year is non-taxable income to the wife.
I was puzzled by the choice of the words tax planning purposes rather than tax purposes. The insertion of the word planning inserts, to my mind, some unnecessary ambiguity. Do you have any insight as to why it says that?
No, I don't. Other than I think what was clear was the trial court wanted to give the wife sort of a leg up, acknowledge that, you know, at this point she hadn't looked for a job. She had already gotten a year's worth of maintenance, but, you know, she still was in the same exact boat she was in the beginning, and said, I agree with what was originally proposed, which is that there would be this, I think they actually used the term undifferentiated support, so sort of, some sort of lump sum for, which was $6,000 a month that was, under the trial court's decree, was supposed to be for child support purposes only. It's not taxable to the wife, and no one's disagreeing. I mean, to the extent they're saying that I'm still not sure, that the IRS might come back later on and say, hey, this is undifferentiated support, you should be paying taxes on it. It's hypothetical. We're not in that situation right now.
Does the record tell us how it's been treated since the decree was entered?
Since the decree?
Have the parties, for example, did the father take a deduction for it, or did the mother report his income? Does the record answer that?
The record doesn't answer that. I mean, and I doubt that's
anything outside the record.
I'm just saying I doubt that's what happened, because again, the decree was clear as to what the trial court's intention was with regards to the support, that it was not taxable to the wife. It was not considered her income. So, you know, tomato, tomato. I don't really not understand, you know, this undifferentiated support. Again, there is some language. Yes, there is some language in that, but we're at a point that it's hypothetical that the IRS might come after them. And if they did,
well,
and it's...
We only have one of them that tends to deduct it, and the other one doesn't.
Right.
So don't worry about it.
Yeah, so, I mean...
understand why it's all in there.
So there would be a remedy available if the IRS interpreted this differently than the parties intended?
Yes. She can go back to court and say, we need a clearer clarification of what the trial court had already done to say that this was not income. Also... with regard to some of the other issues, the missing child support worksheet for year one, it's moot. The year is over. Again, there's no dispute as to how the amount of the transfer payment, which is $2,000, that's an issue that shouldn't even been brought. The adjustment provision, there appears to be some argument that the trial court purported to prevent the mother from adjusting child support within 2 years, and the 24-month mark under the statute. That's not what the order says. It says it shall be reviewed. It'll be reviewed when maintenance when the maintenance drops out. It doesn't say that the wife cannot pursue an adjustment. So, again, and I'm bringing up these issues because this is a case that we shouldn't be here today. There, again, there's no complaint about the amount of the transfer payment. There's no complaint about the amount of maintenance. Yet here we are.
Here's
over
the thing. There's apparently a, point taken, but in general, but this issue about the CBI bonus, counsel just argued that, well, if the CBI bonus had been included, then the court would have had a different overall picture in mind and might well have come up with a different number than 2,000. So let's look a little bit more carefully at this CBI bonus. I mean, I'm looking at the statutory section, which says the court may deviate from the standard calculation based on a finding that a particular source of income included in the calculation of the basic support obligation is not a recurring source of income. Depending on the circumstances, non-recurring income may include bonuses. Deviations for non-recurring income shall be based on a review of the non-recurring income received in the previous two calendar years. Now, what does this tell us here about what was going on and what was discussed below? Was there a deviation? Did there have to be a deviation?
Well, there's a couple of points I want to make. First, actually, to answer Judge Leach's question to counsel, there was evidence. Mr. Remick did testify at trial that the CBI bonus was not guaranteed. He couldn't rely on it. It was a wholly objective bonus that he only got as a lump sum. He couldn't rely on it on a monthly basis for maintenance or for child support.
Oh, I'm trying to find out what the law is.
Okay. I want to address that.
From the standard calculation. Are we looking here at a deviation from the standard calculation?
It's a deviation in terms of the fact that it wasn't included. And if you look,
Can I interrupt you?
Sure.
As I understand it, the law requires that all of that income be included unless the court affirmatively makes a finding that it's non-recurring income. And if it does that, that then provides a basis for deviating from the standard calculation when the court's using the standard calculation. Is that accurate?
That is accurate.
And in this case, the court wasn't using a standard calculation. And my question then is, if it's not using a standard calculation, must it still make the finding that it's non-recurring in order to not include the income on the worksheet, since presumably the court would arrive at the same number since it's aware of the money?
I think that's correct. I mean, if you look at Marriage of Ayad,
Marriage of Ayad?
Yeah, that's just sort of a perfect example. The trial court got the income wrong, but it wasn't necessary on remand to change it because the trial court would have done the same thing. And the trial court talked about that during closing argument, saying, you know, whether I use the CBI income or not, I can make a transfer payment that I think is necessary for these two children and this particular family. And in this case, it was $2,000. It was above any amount that they would have gotten even if they used the income that they were proposing. We ask that you affirm. Thank you.
A couple points, Your Honor.
Do we know from anything that Judge Hillier said that he would have reached the same answer if he'd included the CBI income?
No. There's not anything in the oral ruling or anything that occurred during the trial to indicate that. There's no findings that this was non-reoccurring income, as you aptly pointed out. There's nothing in there where he followed the statutes as to what is required in order to make a deviation one way or the other. The fact is he
was he deviating?
Deviate from the standard calculation.
Well,
he doesn't have to do anything if he's not in the standard calculation.
Well, you make a good point, Judge Gross. But what we don't have, and this is what the importance of the child support worksheet would have been for the first year, it would have shown that Judge Hillier understood, as Judge Becker pointed out, what the respective incomes of the parties were in making the determination as to
that worksheet wouldn't have produced the number the judge came up with, would it? Since the sum of the two incomes is off the table, meaning the judge has to do something different than follow the table.
Well, it's not that the incomes go up to $12,000 net income per year. Mr. Remick's was approximately 9,000. Ms. Remick's was just over 3,000. We're not talking about exceeding the economic table by a great margin, and we don't. And then when you apply the percentages,
did the trial court say, I mean, she just was quoting something from the ruling, which was, whether I include it or not, it looks to me like 2,000 is the right number. Is that
no, that's not what was said at all.
All right.
He just said $2,000 because I think $2,000 is what it should be. That's a more accurate paraphrasing of what he said. He never mentioned including the CBI. He never mentioned including the ESPP. And he never mentioned including it. All he did was specifically exclude it, and that's why it's
error. Do you agree that he has the discretion whether to include it or not?
No.
Is it your position then that the statute, because it says 2 years, requires that any income that occurs in two successive years must be included?
I believe that you have to include bonuses automatically.
Okay. Would you agree that he doesn't have to include it if he makes an affirmative finding that it's non-recurring?
No. He has the right to deviate downward from what it is if he makes those findings, which he didn't make in this case. So you have to include the bonus income
from the absence of that finding.
Yeah, that it was recurring. The failure to make a finding on something they would bear the burden of proof on, which would be a deviation, you would infer that it was recurring. And the last thing, if I may, I know I'm at zero.
Give you 25 seconds.
Okay, is that that no matter how clear the decree is, you cannot tell the federal government what is taxable and what is not taxable. So undifferentiated support does make a difference.
That probably went without saying.
Okay, well.
I think we get it.
Okay, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate it.
Court will be in recess.
All rise.
Nice. Good job.
Thanks. So if you're satisfied and this goes back down, what are you going to do with that lawyer?
Well, it's not going to go to arbitration before JDR.